Entering into the book of Joshua, we'll have 2 weeks where we're looking at Joshua. These first 12 chapters, of course, are among some of the best known in Scripture. Yes?
Is there a book up there?
Oh.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, anybody need to borrow a copy of the Bible here?
Yes, I'm
going to
get one for
the
people over here.
Okay, there you go.
Thank you.
Anybody else in your country tonight?
Okay. Are among some of the most famous passages or events in biblical history. And tonight's always kind of a struggle because Jericho in particular is just such an absolutely fascinating story and place. And the archaeological site is tremendously helpful and informative. And so now I have to run a kind of fast, I guess, in these 12 chapters. And that's part of the reason I pare it down so that I've got a little bit more time to talk. But Joshua chapter 1 has a couple of things, brethren, that we just want to touch lightly upon. Of course, we are told in the first verse that Moses has died. We read about that last week in Deuteronomy 34. Joshua, the son of Nun, has been selected by God and commissioned as well through the laying on of hands with Moses, so that he now is going to become the leader of these Israelites. And he is told in verse 6, if you look in the right-hand column there, just the first part, to be strong and of good courage. A little bit later, another verse, in verse 7, he is told to be strong and of good courage. You skip down in the middle of verse 9, and he is told to be strong and of good courage. And if you turn over the page to the last verse in chapter 1, guess what Joshua is told to be? He's told to be strong and of good courage. God is with him. He cannot fail. Every place he sets his foot, they will take possession of it. They will conquer every enemy that comes against them, bar none. Now, if that's the case, why is he being told to be strong and of good courage? You think he would just smile and head for out? You know, all right. Why?
Without faith, nothing good can happen.
Amen.
Are they going to personally be involved in this work?
Yes.
Did God guarantee that nobody's going to get hurt while they're doing this work?
No.
Did God guarantee that every one of their soldiers is going to survive and come home at the end of battle? No. God's purposes are larger than just a single individual. They still need to have the faith that Bill mentioned. They still need to have this strength and this courage. They, knowing that God is on their side, still have to summon their own resources because they're going to be challenged in the process. Carol, you got a comment?
Well, just to be strong, they may be asked to do things that in their own mind doesn't make any sense. But God told them to do it and to do it with strength, not feebleness.
Strength in the sense of conviction and the faith that Bill mentioned rather than, you know, muscle.
Even though going to be divinely guided, and that's pretty obvious throughout the history. But we as humans still have to be reminded all the time.
Well, that's right, and we sure learned that from the Israelites in the wilderness, and they're endlessly forgetful. And so God is renewing his relationship with the leader of Israel and informing him that his choice of Joshua is going to require a lot of effort on Joshua's part. He's got work to do. Now, I'm going to take just the briefest moment for the sake of anybody that might not have been with us on Sunday, and certainly for all of those that we know are following the class through the website, now listening to the recordings each week. Please turn in your Bible to page 230. On 230, we'll be looking at Joshua chapter 1 in that very first paragraph, so top of the left-hand column, verse 12. To the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh, Joshua spoke, saying, "Remember the word which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying," here's the quote, "the Lord your God is giving you in this passage," what? "Rest, and is giving you this land. Your wives, your little ones, and your livestock shall remain in the land which Moses gave you on this side of the Jordan, the east side, but you shall pass before your brethren armed, all your mighty men of valor, and help them until the Lord has given your brethren, what? Rest, as he gave you, and they also have taken possession of the land which the Lord your God is giving them. They are being promised two things here. They are being promised a four-letter word that starts with an R and ends with T, rest, and the land. Okay, and the idea here very obviously is, once you are done with the battles that Joshua as the leader has to be strong and have courage, and they themselves will have to be strong and have courage, eventually, after much battle and years of effort, they will have what when they conquered the land? Rest. They will receive rest. That is, there will be a relaxation of the army's responsibilities and going off to battle and all the fears and problems. You know, they'll be free from those things. Joshua, in this passage, and chapter 1, the people as well, are being informed that there's a lot of work that lies ahead, but on the far side, there will be rest from that work. And they will possess the land. Now, please turn over in your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 4. Ask me what page that's on, and I haven't got a clue. But I can now tell you that it's page 1393. Okay, I forgot about that one. This is the page number. So we turn to 1393 in the Chronological Study Bible or to Hebrews chapter 4. We touched on this on Sunday. Some of you may not have been here. But we want to just read this little chapter very quickly. In verse 1, therefore, since a promise remains of entering his what? God's rest. Let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. For indeed the gospel was preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. For we who have believed do enter that rest, as he has said, and this is now Psalm 95, so I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. When God swore in his wrath that they would not enter into his rest, what rest was God talking about in Hebrews? Don't answer that yet. Then, as that verse continues, verse 3, after the quote from Psalm 95, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world, God rested from his works, and they were finished from that point on, from the foundation of the world. Verse 4, he has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way. And God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this place, they shall not enter my rest. I rested on the seventh day, and they won't enter it. Now verse 6. Since therefore, it remains that some must enter it. When the Hebrew letter was written, 30 years after Christianity was born, there remained a rest for some to enter. And those to whom it was first preached did not enter because of disobedience. Now think about that sixth verse for a minute. Did the Jews enter into the rest that Joshua was talking about in chapter 1? Did they enter into the rest that God promised in Joshua 1? Yes, they got into the land. They finished all their battles. Okay? Now, though, he says in verse 6, it remains that some must enter it. And those to whom it was first preached, the wilderness Jews, did not enter because of disobedience. You should be confused at this point. That's good. In verse 7, again he designates a certain day, saying in David, today, after such a long time, now David lived a long time after Joshua, as it has been said, here's Psalm 95 again, today if you'll hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. Now look at verse 8. If Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. Did Joshua give them the land? Yes, by the end of Joshua, we will twice be told, chapter 21 and chapter 24, not one promise failed. He gave them that land. Did they keep a weekly Sabbath while they were in that land? Well, it's only 3 days in, or four, whichever, I forget now. They had the Passover, and of course, all the other institutions of that law. They were keeping a weekly Sabbath. They had rest from all their warfare. They had the land. Joshua gave them that. But after that, we have David in Psalm 95 saying on behalf of God that God said, they'll never enter my rest. But they did enter that rest. They'll never enter my rest. Well, there were a lot of people that died because they were unfaithful in the wilderness, but their children, grandchildren, entered the rest that Joshua had. Maybe God was referencing yet another rest. Well, look at it in verse 8. If Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. 9. There remains therefore a rest for the people of God. For he who has entered his rest has himself also ceased from his works as God did from his. In Genesis, when God ceased in chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, from his creation works, when did he start working again? He never did. On the sixth day, he finished his creative work. On the seventh day, he stopped that creative work. He didn't create anything. And on the next day, the eighth day, did God go back to work? No. That rest has continued. There has been no more creation since the, what was it, verse 4 or 6? 3, since the foundation of the world. No more creative work has gone on. When God ceased from his work, how long did it last? Forever. And now, Joshua gave them rest from their enemies. Joshua gave them rest from the wilderness. Joshua gave them a cyclical seven-day rest. Joshua gave them the land. But did he give them the rest that God swore the unfaithful would never enter? No. That is an eternal, infinite, unending, unabated, uninterrupted rest from what? From all works. When God was saying, they will never enter my rest, he wasn't limiting it to going into Israel. He had a spiritual and an eternal concept in mind as well, a place that is a promised land we call heaven. Okay? And that remained. After Joshua, there remained a rest to enter when they were already in the land. David was in the land. Not that rest, but an eternal cessation from works. We get to go to be with God forever. It's called heaven. Now, come on back to chapter 1 and verses 12 through 15. In the margin of your Bible, whether this one or your regular study Bible, you certainly want to write in there, see Hebrews chapter 4. Just all of it. Because that's what Hebrews 4 is talking about. If Joshua had given them the full, complete, eternal rest, would never have spoken another one after it. Okay, now, Rahab hides the spies, and you know about that. I can't add anything more to that than what is written in the text. We're going to skip that. I'll need the time desperately. In chapter 3, you can see the headline there on page 231 says that Israel crosses the Jordan. And indeed, they did. So now, if you look at the map that I have on the screen, here is a town called Shittim, which is on the east side of the Jordan River. From here, they march across the plains of Moab, this being the mountains of Moab, and they came over here to Gilgal, somewhere in this area. We haven't found it, don't know where it is. So it's got a question mark. It's somewhere real close to Jericho. That became a base camp for quite a few sorties and battles that will take place to come. Jericho's right here. This map's not a great one, but you can see right at the foot of all these mountains, which lead up into the Jerusalem, which is 14 miles away on the ascent of the Dumah. And it is, the hill country of Israel, the prettier country of Israel. They go into Jericho. We'll read about it in just a minute. And, of course, they'll succeed there. Then they'll head to Ai, and get not quite sure where that is, and what will happen in Ai. They will fail. So, at this point, they are preparing and have prepared themselves. They ready all their arms and their soldiers. And here we go. God said we can do it. Be strong and courageous. Years ahead of us, but we will eventually take the promised land. So, Rahab is the first to recognize that Jericho and anybody else that comes against these people is what? Doomed. Okay? Now, what's curious about this chapter is only to say, look, where does Rahab live? What had she been hearing about? Things that are hundreds and hundreds of miles away. The word that went all the way back to Egypt, when they crossed out of Egypt on dry land, has spread through the whole Middle East. So when these guys show up, you've got problems. Okay? So they cross the Jordan on the same way they left Egypt. They entered their promised land. God has two portals, if you will, out of captivity into the promised land. Now, I wouldn't want to make too much about it, but 1 Corinthians does a little bit. I won't take the time tonight, but there is a baptismal reference there. Nobody gets wet, but you do go down into what? The channel of the water. What's the water doing? Standing up on either side. And you go down into that and pass through it, and when you come out the other side, what do you have? Freedom. Yes. No, I don't know that anybody knows where it is. It's thought to be several miles upstream, though. So not close, but not sure. I don't know that ever, a specific location has been found. Okay, so that brings us now in chapters 3 through 5, not just the crossing of the Jordan, but the renewal of the sign of the covenant, which we didn't have a lot of time to talk about as we were coming through. Other classes, we touch on that. But this sign of the covenant demonstrates a particular, most unusual relationship with God. Now, chapter 6 through 8. Let me show you a bunch of maps and a bunch of pictures, and try to get ourselves situated here. I have to apologize a little bit. My photographs didn't turn out quite as clear as I'd hope they would, and I have to review those. But one atlas I've got does an outstanding job of giving elevations here, with this particular style of graphics. I really like it. You'll be seeing more of these. But north, as you can see now, is actually pointed that way. So coming directly from the east, here's Baal Peor, which is the location of terrible sins and problems. But Joshua sends the spies ahead to Jericho. So they're going to meet Rahab. They establish a camp at Gilgal, somewhere here, still in these plains of Moab. They're going to take Jericho, and then march directly to Ai and what? Fail. Please note on the map, every step they take from Jericho is what? It's uphill. It is very really an uphill battle from now on. This is the hill country. So everywhere they go through here, they're going to be in that hill country until they get all the way down into this region here, which is called the Shephelah, and that is on the far side of the mountains and wondrously fertile ground that eventually will be occupied there by the Philistines. In David's day, that'll all be the Philistine area there. So just note that they're taking off from the lowest point on earth, going uphill, maybe 3,000 feet by the time you get to Jerusalem,
and fighting these battles for the Lord.
Now, I think I'm going to zoom in here just a little bit on this next one. I should have thought to do this. But the very first campaign is in the south. What they're doing first is going around that north end of the Dead Sea and then heading straight across and down to take the southern reaches of what will be Judah and Benjamin's territory particularly. So the south came first. Who's also battling with them, though? 2.5 tribes from the very far north, which had their land on the east side of the Jordan, way off of this map to the north, but they have their land already. They have their rest already. They now have to march their guys down, join them here, and, you know, we're going to go ahead and take care of Jericho and get this business accomplished. Okay, now, just a bunch of pictures. Now, you see, I try to tie everything together as best I can so that, you know, we are being immersed in these various ideas. So I've been showing you on Sunday morning pictures of Jericho, totally unrelated to the material I've been teaching, but you've been seeing Jericho in preparation for tonight. Standing on the mountain that is immediately adjacent to Jericho, you can see the dirt that they're standing on right there. This, if I can get my screen to work, is Jericho. Old Jericho. The fortified city of Jericho. The fortress of Jericho. Remember, this is Jericho today, and it was Jericho back then too. The people lived and farmed all around. But when somebody came to attack, then they would fall back to what's here called the city of Jericho. Maybe it'd be better to think of it as the citadel of Jericho, the strong half of Jericho. But all that barren, you know, hill that you see there is generations, generations, and generations of generations, which is quite arguably the oldest city on earth that we've been able to uncover, of which there are any remains. And that's quite an archaeological site. There's only one National Geographic discovered about a year ago, that, and not in Israel, that might be older. But so far as we can tell, that at least is one of two oldest cities we know, you know, on earth. So we're going to be looking at that citadel. Here is what it looks like from ground level, there in the plains of Moab, looking at the mountains of Moab in the distance. This is it. It's not big. Not big at all. These are umbrellas that tourists can stand under, you know, because it is very hot there. And, you know, it wouldn't take you 5 minutes to walk up the hill on this side from the parking lot, come up and walk straight across to the other side, and it's over. It's a 5-minute walk. It's not 2 minutes from side to side. Very, very small area. That was the fort. Okay? This is what's going to be circumvented each day, isn't it? 7 priests, their trumpets, what do? Walk all the way around, blowing their trumpets. And they stop. What do they do the next day? Do it again. 3rd day, 4th day, 5th day, 6th day, every day. How many times do they go around? 1 time. Then what happened? They just got interested. Walked around 7 times, and then, of course, the walls fell down. More of that in just a minute. I do want to emphasize, though, that this is not, you know, just utterly inhospitable territory. You'll see why in just a minute. But even today, there's a fair amount of agriculture that's taking place, and it's literally referred to as the city of palm trees. Palm trees just throughout the area there, the city of palms. So when you're now standing on this dirt, which is the old city fortress itself, that's what it looks like if you look out at the inhabitants of today and looking off toward the Dead Sea, which would be right here behind the palm tree. Okay. Then, here we go again, standing on that citadel itself here in the very foreground. and looking to the mountains of Moab in the distance over here, and you can see just a whole lot of the Dead Sea right there, that little stripe. And I realize again, I like me can't understand why y'all don't sit in the front row, but I'm so visually based. But if you get a little closer, you'll be able to see it, you know, very easily. And so when you're in Jericho, the view is magnificent at all points of the compass. It's just wonderful. The mountains of Moab are gorgeous. The Dead Sea stretches out for miles. You've got towering mountains that are immediately adjacent, like this one right here. This is the ascent of Edomim, they call it, which is and was the main road through the valleys and which is the wilderness of Judea up to Jerusalem. So Jericho itself, the old city, is like right here, very, very close to these mountains and that road. Here's what it looks like in an aerial view. And please note again, it's that same road that the last picture was looking right like that. Herod had his palace here. Herod died here, Herod the Great. He spent a lot of time down here. Much of the year, the weather's magnificent. It's the best place to winter. This ascent of Adullam takes you up along either the hills or the valley, you go either way through these different areas. And then finally, right there is Jerusalem. Which, when you're standing in Jerusalem on certain hills, you can look right down and see the Dead Sea. It's only 14 miles away. It's a strategic location. It is very comfortable much of the year, though in the summer it's not at all. See? And therefore, really a very desirable place. When the spies hide after Rahab's house, this is likely the territory they went up to. They didn't have to go a quarter of a mile, and they would be climbing steep hills that are very convoluted like that, in which they can easily hide several days before they come back. This is the mountain that sits immediately adjacent to the fortress itself. Now, by the way, there are cable cars that go up to this now. It is referred to as the Mount of Temptation, but nobody on the planet knows where Jesus was in the 40-day wilderness fast. And so this is just a local attempt to get you to spend money to get on the three cable cars that take you to the top. You know, we never did. But the best view of the area certainly is from there, too. You know, but don't think for a minute that just because today they call it the Mount of Temptation, it's actually where Jesus was tempted. But, you know, brother, depending on the lighting, depending on the weather, a really gorgeous thing to behold, and it's very prominent. It's immediately there. It's considerably closer than the Cobra Hills are. Here we are now looking north from Jericho. Now, why would anybody want to live by the Dead Sea where the water's so salty you'd kill you in a minute, you know, if you tried to drink it? Because of this thing, which is called Elisha's Spring. This is a picture from 1894. The area now owned by the Sultan of Turkey, his agent sowed wheat there, which in that time, you know, was ripening. This spring provided Jericho with water. And it still produces enough to irrigate the whole plain down there. So they're calling the plain of Judea now because they're on the other side of the river rather than Moab. But that spring is still pumping water, and that's a picture I took 4 years ago. Water just flowing straight up out of the ground. And then heads actually in two different directions there, so one, you know, left and right. Brethren, water is life. And they had huge volumes of it. And the spring is the first thing you come to when the tour bus parks. Whoop, let me go back. And you get ready to go look at the site itself. This is Farrell Jenkins right here, and the rest of the people on our tour, as I stood there, you know, the sun was too bright, just didn't get, you know, the light right, but these hills right there, which they're already on, is Jericho, old Jericho. So that, they had immediate, inexhaustible year-round water supply for that city. You get attacked in that town and what? As far as water goes, you'd last forever. Okay? Now, after the water problem, this is the oldest structure known to man. The oldest one that has ever been found. And they can't quite figure out what it's for.
Okay. The grid's been put there because there's an access hole and you could fall in,
you know, and be injured or killed. It's fairly big, as you can see now, when this person is standing upon it.
In this case, the grate has been lifted and leaned up, and then, I can't, it's behind the rock kind of right here, you can't quite see it. But our best guess is that that's a granary.
So the people would collect from their crops, keep a supply of grain stored, so they have food for a siege. Brethren, this is an extremely strategic and desirable location where you can grow crops, have an inexhaustible water supply, a fabulous view, and about half of the year, great weather. So if you occupy it in those days, what would you immediately want to do? Keep it. You'd want to fortify it. And you'd want to really fortify it. Because you know a lot of other people would really want it. It would become a place of great contention because it's highly desirable. Here you can see some of the excavations where you're standing up on the site itself. This is not the same structure we saw earlier, everything being built out of stone. And various camps have been cut by the archaeologists to get down the various levels here. Fascinating site. Now, let's see if we can try to rebuild it from what we have in the archaeological remains to get an idea of what it may have looked like as Joshua's priests were encircling it and he, the general, was getting ready to attack.
It had a double wall system with plenty of housing structures, but there were people who also lived there year-round. And so when the walls came tumbling down, roofs would have been caving in,
and I can zoom in on this now twice, give you a little bit better picture here.
It was a part of the original structure that it was ringed with what would be buttressing housing that would help to support that wall.
So it was integrated, built in together, cross-stressed,
so that this thing was, one, fabulously hard to conquer wall. You can see they try to show the broken timbers being down inside the house there. And here's a little window, which on that fateful day had what hanging in it?
Crimson thread. When the walls came tumbling down, which her house was on the wall, okay,
did her part of the wall fall down?
Apparently not, or if it did, it still left the house exposed with her whole family inside. Here's another artist's rendition, and again, we have the archaeological remains. We know
it was a double-walled city, and it was fortified by the houses that were built along the wall side there.
So this artist has done exactly the same thing, trying to show how that wall was just impregnable. It was just a fabulously defensible thing. Now, today, here are the measurements that have been done, and when you go to the site, as you originally enter it, they'll point out that you can walk up to the rubble, which apparently fell outward where it has remained to this day,
shows that, because that's what they're digging up, and it fell outward, and thereby allowed these Jews to have a ramp of rocks from the wall that took them up to the ramp that was in between the walls, where they would have been meeting the second wall that had also fallen down, all the rubble rolling down, making a perfect entryway, for them to go up and capture this city.
So, from the ground level down here
to the high point up here was a total of 46 feet.
Doesn't sound, very serious with kind of military weaponry we have today, but at that time, of course, that's pretty serious. And 6 feet thick, then housing, of course, as well behind it. Okay, so do you have any questions about chapters 6, 7, and 8? Or 6 and 7, about Jericho?
Okay. Brethren, they pointed out well in the uninspired part, commentary that you have in the book, that it is such an ancient city that it's different, and of course these events are taking place probably 3,500 years ago, somewhere in that vicinity. 32, that it's very, very difficult for us, after so much time has passed, to be very sure about certain aspects of this.
there's not enough there to tell us whether Joshua was there in the 1200s or the 1400s, for instance. We know the event took place. We have the remains of the event taking place. But that's not to say that the archaeology just absolutely establishes, that there's a God in heaven. There is a God in heaven. But nothing that you've ever read in the Bible contradicts that or should be viewed as some kind of weakness that would suggest, that it's not true. On the other hand, we've talked about this a lot before, the archaeology does not absolutely establish that there's a God in heaven either. What does that, I think, is the foretelling of the future. So we want to be careful not to make too much out of archaeology, but just to certainly recognize never once has anything in archaeology ever been found to be at variance with what the scriptures themselves teach. Now, we'll talk about chapter 8 here. In chapter 8, we understand Ai, we know about Achan, he was covetous, he couldn't withstand the temptation, he stole a garment and some silver and gold, buried it underneath his tent. God, foretelling the future, if you will, causes people to come by, select each one, knew exactly who it was, pointed it out, and needed trial or investigation or DNA, and he's the guy. And so he is responsible for their failure at Ai. Ai was much smaller, not a big deal, thought they could knock it over with very few people. In fact, how many did they have at Jericho, do you remember? I think it was 40,000, wasn't it? We've had 40,000 soldiers here, and they only took a handful of thousands when they got to Ai, and of course then, defeated. Identify Achan, put him to death. Who else do we put to death?
Family.
His whole family. Then what do we do with everything he owns?
Destroy it.
And if ISIS does that today, how do you react? See, we're really upset about that, aren't we? Okay? But God ordered it to be done back then. Was it right when Joshua did it? Sure it was. Okay? And again, we have to be careful, brethren, because unwittingly, I think, I frequently hear it from saints, we decry things as inherently evil today that God requires in the past. So we have to be a little more sophisticated, a little more careful, about our thinking. God has never told anybody to do something that is inherently sinful. Nobody's ever been asked to do something that is wrong. Okay? So it is not evil in and of itself to do these things. One has to have a justifiable reason. Okay? Does ISIS? I don't think so. Okay? But does God? Well, of course he does. And so let's just remember that, lest we be accusing God of doing something that's untoward. Why? We ask ourselves. Of course, they talk about it in the book as well. Brother, my particular theory goes maybe a little bit to what we're currently seeing in Israel. I'm dying that I'm not there right now. I wish I was there. I had planned to arrive yesterday with a tour group that is being led by a man who was on the first tour that Don and I took. If I could have been there, I would have been there. Would I be worried about going over there? No. What you're seeing on the news, is bad. There's bad stuff happening. When you saw what happened in Baltimore, did that cause you to be terrified and want to move to Canada? Did you want you to tell all your friends in Europe, don't come to America, it's burning down, look at Ferguson and Baltimore. What do we do when we see those things happen? We realize that they are what? Isolated and unusual events. And that it's usually not too hard to know that after midnight you probably shouldn't be in this or that part of town. That's true of Eugene. Okay? And we have murders in Eugene. We just had a whole spate of them, didn't we? Everybody scratched their heads. Why, we've had more murders in 1 week, I think it was 2 weeks ago, than they had seen just the longest time. But I would go to Eugene, and I would go to Israel. But you're seeing pictures now of teenagers with knives who apparently are not a part of any group and are taking it upon themselves to go out and murder total strangers that they've never laid eyes on before. Okay, that's
That's a wild deal, isn't it? What kind of a heart does it take to do that? A heart, brethren, that is just utterly dark. And what is the likelihood that that heart could ever be repaired? Not very high, really. And we're taught in the New Testament, for instance, some people will sin in such a manner that you are forbidden to pray for them. You are not supposed to pray for them anymore. That's really something. And with Genesis 15, for instance, when a nation got bad enough, when its iniquity is full, what does God do? He destroys it. And that's not mean and cruel and unfair. I think it is God in His divine wisdom recognizing these people have sunk so low that from their birth up, generations back, all they have seen is evil and been taught that it is good. They have been trained to believe that darkness is light. And it's too late for them. Okay? So what God did was to exterminate a plague of humanity that had descended so deeply into sin and hard-heartedness and darkness that it was irretrievable. This, I think, is what all these conquests are about. And you'll note as we go through these chapters that not everybody is put to death. So, in chapter 8, I did this again last week, here's your Mount Gerizim and evil. They were to come to this place, the natural amphitheater, and recite the blessings and the curses, which in Joshua 8, 33-35, they now fulfilled God's command through Moses to do this.
Just to go back, Jericho, definitely God showed them that it was God who was giving the victory. Mm-hmm. And that's why all the spoils were to go to God. They sort of thought when they went to Ai, well, we don't need all of those people. We should be able to do it with just this many. And somebody failed, and 35 men were killed. All of the children of Israel were supposed to go to the stoning. Not just a few.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, because they had to realize that their life was on the line if they disobeyed God.
Carol pointed out something that I've always thought was one of the scariest things in all of Scripture. And especially with Achan, we see this, you know, very prominently. Your personal influence can have much good, you know, on the lives of others. But also what? It can be terribly destructive. Okay? And so your influence as an individual, always remember, involves a lot more than just you. It involves your family, it involves everybody. And yes, when the stoning of Achan took place, God wanted everybody to participate in that. When the blessings and cursings take place, God wants everybody to take a part in that. And God was constantly doing this with these people, showing, you know, that stand or fall, you all do it together. You know, they were a unit. The tribes in the north had to fight for the tribes in the south, you know, when they came in to take the promised land. It's just endless. And brethren, I think really in a quite true sense, as Christians, that's the case. You fell up out there in the world during the week, and somebody knows you're a member of the Coburg Road Church of Christ. Does that have an impact on all the rest of this? Sure does. Okay? I go and misbehave and slap my Adventist preachers around or something. What are all the Adventists going to think? By the way, really honestly, I was stunned last afternoon, you know, at those Adventists. I just could not believe what I was hearing. And truly, I'm not sure but what, I was so stunned that I walked out and I left my briefcase with my wallet and my phone box. So I got a call from the preacher, email, you know, he said, about here, there'll be somebody there at 10 o'clock. So I went in and set up the Adventist building in Springfield at 10:15 this morning. And I opened the door and I could hear somebody talking. Took a few steps around the corner, you know, and I came to the classroom that we always study in, myself and these Adventist preachers. And here was a guy at the far end of the room in a chair facing me in a class that would have been about maybe half the size of the one we have right here, and maybe not even quite half, but, you know, 10 o'clock class, obviously. And so I came in and I was immediately embarrassed, you know, the door was open and he's looking right at me and nobody in the room could see me. They've all got their backs to me. And immediately he says, "Brother Larry, your briefcase is right over here." Am I an Adventist brother?
No. Okay. But I'm getting kind of familiar around there, you know, and messages are being passed and everything. And all I needed was for a strange guy to show up, and immediately he had my name, you know, and my reputation is at stake there, too. I didn't interrupt his class and say, look, I'm not your brother. Nothing of the kind. But I'm just trying to say, God has bound us all together, and we better never forget it. It'll help you avoid more sin. It'll help you to be more active in the responsibilities God has for us.
I really must hasten now. This is the phase two of the campaign. We've already talked about it, and you've already read some of the little speeches there. So I'm not going to go through it again. But after they met these Gibeonites, they're now turning southward and coming back downhill into the Shephelah, taking city after city after city with great success.
So that's chapters 9 and 10. I do want to say just one thing very quickly about the treaty with the Gibeonites.
Because I think it is profoundly important that we remember this in all your future studies, and particularly in the study of marriage and divorce and remarriage, for instance. You say, well, what has that got to do with the Gibeonites? Well, it has something to do. What happened? The Gibeonites, like Rahab had heard, we are toast. How are we going to survive? We can't. Well, I got an idea, somebody thought. Let's fake that we are not living in this country and therefore would be destroyed by these people. We'll lie to them and deceive them and see if we can't get them to enter into a covenant with us. So they had the old shoes and the old bread and the old wine, and they came staggering in all dusty, you know, and it worked. They were great actors. And they convinced the Jews that they'd come from a far country. They did not live in the area where everybody was to be put to death here. And so they tricked them into making a covenant. All right, we won't kill you. Then it comes to their attention. Uh-oh. We have made a covenant not to harm a people that God ordered us to harm. Now what are we going to do? Well, apparently they had not consulted God to begin with. That's how they got themselves into this jam. But what does God tell them? You made a covenant. And so now, what? Now you've got to keep that covenant. Now, I'm not going to get into all the ins and outs of marriage and divorce. I'm not getting into any of those ins and outs. But I want you to remember that God thinks something about covenants. And maybe even if you're in one that you should not have gotten into, at least we learned this much from the Gibeonites. When these people, the Jews, got into a covenant that they weren't supposed to get into, they still had to do what? Keep the covenant that they got into. That can have far-ranging ramifications on a lot of studies, brothers. Just always remember the Gibeonites. When you mess up, things happen, you know, but the sometimes proposed solution that people come up with, if it requires the breaking of a covenant, might not necessarily, you know, be the best one. So, from Gilgal to their camp, they're marching all the way up here, had this exchange with the Gibeonites, and as we get later into chapters 9 and 10, everybody else, when they saw that they had made a covenant with the Jews, that Gibeon was now friend to the Jews, then all these five kings down here, Ebron, Lachish, Hebron, Jarnus, what did they decide they were going to do? You know, whoop up on them Gibeonites, boy. Okay? And by the way, brethren, how bad did it get for the Jews now that they were in the covenant that they had to keep, which they never should have gotten in the first place? Now they're in battle, and their own people are dying, defending a people that they were what? Supposed to already put to death. So the entanglements, you know, are pretty great, and consequences pretty far-reaching, but they're sure enough keeping the covenant now, aren't they? And they're paying a very, very high price for it. In chapter 10, that's the valley where the sun stood still. In 2011, Farrell and I just parked by the side of the road. I was very surprised the first time I'd seen any cactus, so I would later see it, you know, quite a few places in Israel. They've got, you know, it is a warmer climate in certain parts, and so the cactus, you know, can be prevalent. Today, of course, it's got a nice freeway running through there. not quite like it was before. But brethren, is there plenty of room there for a couple armies to get together and have a fight? See? It's perfect territory for that. The guy was fight and flight.
It goes on in Ajalon that this is the place where they asked for the sun and the moon to stand still, which, despite some of the ideas that might have been suggested on that page in the uninspired block, you know, I have absolutely no doubt, the scriptures, I think, unquestionably clear, that the sun stood still. There was a miracle that took place there, and God caused the success of the Jews. Well, that, of course, takes us to chapter 11. In chapter 11, again, using the same similar, or the same series of maps, in a northern thrust now, Joshua moves from Gilgal and pushes the Canaanites clear up beyond Tyre, which is clear on out of Israel. And the city of Hazor, that's how you pronounce that, their Z's sound as if they have a T in front of it. Hazor is today another of these amazingly wonderful archaeological sites. I'm out of time, so I can't even show you. But I do want you to just know that the Shinnereth that you read in Joshua in the Old Testament is the Sea of Galilee. Way back then, it was called the Sea of Shinnereth. Now it's going to be called the Sea of Galilee. And Lake Hula, Hula is how it's pronounced, like hoop. Lake Hula is now being restored. The desperate need for water, once all of the immigrants have come back into Israel since 1948, they started developing all of this, you know, they're taking the water out of the Jordan. They finally completely drained Lake Hula. It disappeared. And now they're trying to restore it again for, you know, ecological reasons. And it's a beautiful region, really beautiful, but also very swampy area up there. So note, though, that after, in the first campaign, the initial battles, they first went due west, and then they turned south. And then, immediately again, turned north, and they ran the full length of Israel all the way to Dan, which, as I pointed out in previous lessons, would become a catchword for all of Israel, you would say, from Dan to Beersheba. Beersheba being in the south. So, at this point, early on in a first campaign, they have traversed from south to north the whole land. There's 1,000 battles ahead, but they have walked the whole length of the promised land in their initial battles. Comment or question?